Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexiderm, and we are joined once again by our friend David French, because we are all Frenchists around here, aren't we? Good to talk with you, David.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it very much.
You have been a very, very busy guy, and just before we started this, we were both reading the same thing, I think, because I did not think that the issue of the Alien and Sedition Acts would come up anytime soon, but apparently some people are now, like, it's enjoying a strange new respect. Would that be a fair way of putting it? like a revival.
Yeah. I'm not sure how widespread it is, but you know, I just got an email from the Catholic League, and it was talking about the debate that I had with Sourabh Amari late last week at Catholic University, and talking about dealing with what I have come to understand now is, I think, the single most pressing national crisis besetting the United States, which is that there are apparently 35 chapters of Drag Queen Story Hour in the United States. And we had an argument over, over whether we should toss aside some bedrock First Amendment doctrines for the sake of stopping drag queens from using library facilities. And the Catholic League sent out an email that said that David French presented the libertarian position, Sourabh Amari presented the social conservative position, and then it ends with, it has in there, not all exercises of speech are equal, and some are worthy of censorship. Indeed, the same Congress that passed the First Amendment in 1791 passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, barring seditious speech 7 years later. And so that is where we are. We are bringing back, or at least offering a tribute to, one of the worst laws passed out of the American Congress.
Well, it is a contrarian take, because generally the Alien Sedition Act is not cited as one of the great achievements of the Founding Fathers, is it?
No. It is not generally considered to be a tribute to the founding generation. Instead, it's a symbol of how every single generation of politicians, even those who... It was not the same Congress that passed the Bill of Rights, but just as a point of fact. But even that same generation of people that once they achieve power can be tempted to abuse power. And the founders were every bit as human as any other generation of politicians. And it shouldn't surprise any one of us that, yes, even the founding generation could be tempted to abuse power even so soon after the American Revolution. So
even the most fundamental rights are, in fact, rather fragile. And this was one of those moments where they were tempted to embrace a non-free speech tradition, and then decided rather quickly that was a big mistake. That was a huge mistake. And it didn't take very long for them to realize it was a mistake. But Catholic League and, you know, back with a banner.
Right. I mean, you know, look, the America's constitutional liberties have been under attack in various ways, shapes, and forms since the moment of ratification. I mean, this is, you know, it's a big, messy country with a lot of imperfect people in it. The American commitment to individual liberty has never been perfectly, has never been perfectly applied. I mean, gosh, you know, we can talk from 1791, the ratification of the Bill of Rights, to 1964. African Americans in this country were subject to what should have been, on its face, a grotesquely unconstitutional de jure discrimination for a very, very long time, even after the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Sadly, even after the ratification of the Civil War amendments that eliminated slavery, they did not, unfortunately, in large sections of the South, create equal protection under the law. So, you know, it's been a fight from the founding. The founding wasn't the end of the revolution, so to speak. It was the beginning of a long battle to create a more perfect union.
And now we are struggling over the future of Drag Queen Story Hour. So let's come back to that in a moment, because I did watch the debate, and a couple things struck me, and I wanted to get your take about that particular issue, because that really, I thought, encapsulized this debate between more traditional pluralistic democratic conservatism and the new illiberalism. But of course, because we are all prisoners of the now, because we are prisoners of the news cycle, John Bolton is out. And I just want to get your take on this, because, you know, on one level, it's not surprising, because, of course, John Bolton was never a perfect match for Donald Trump. And this is the way everybody ends up in the administration. It was rather striking. The president, and the president, of course, has a penchant for managing and firing by humiliation. But the way it all played out, and let's talk about that first, and then we'll talk about more of the substance. They met, John Bolton says, and he's telling everybody in the world, I offered to resign. He says, the president says, we'll talk about it tomorrow. And then Donald Trump, with very little fanfare, fires him on Twitter, citing, you know, all of their many, many disagreements, taking everybody by surprise. So why do you think that Donald Trump felt he needed to do it that way? And by the way, the assumption behind my question is that I'm believing John Bolton's version of this, not the White House version of this.
Well, I mean, I am not necessarily a person who thinks that when Donald Trump tweets that there's a lot of forethought in it. So I don't know that I would ascribe a strategic reason for it. It might be that he decided in the moment to do it and just did it. And didn't feel a need to do it. He just felt a desire to do it. Perhaps he was peeved in the moment. It's really hard to know when you're talking when you're talking about a guy who is so obviously captured by his own impulses. I tend to go with sort of the Occam's razor explanation. He did it then not out of any grand plan, but because he just wanted to.
No, I think that's almost certainly true, but on the other hand, the way it also played out, I did wonder whether or not he just wanted to make sure that John Bolton did not resign a la James Mattis with a letter making it about principle. He did not want to give John Bolton the chance to go out on his own terms, and he certainly didn't want it to be framed as somehow a principled protest against the failed Taliban appeasement at Camp David initiative.
Yeah, you know, that's entirely possible. I mean, I think that's certainly a plausible reading of it. It's just so hard to know. I mean, I think that's as plausible as anything else that I've heard. And, you know, what this tells me, it seems as if we've got just an awful lot of disarray around this Taliban policy. Some of the New York Times reporting on, you know, this Taliban Camp David gambit that when the president tweeted it out, it took a ton of people by surprise, including people who should not have been taken by surprise at this notion. And so there's a real, it looks like we've got a lot of disarray here.
Well, and also it does sound like, going back to John Bolton, I've never been a huge John Bolton fan. Let me put the cards on the table. You know, other folks disagree with me about this. I've never really been a big fan. Clearly, he got the job because he was, like so many other people in this administration, had auditioned on Fox News, and he said things on television that the president liked. It seems somewhat ironic that he would be ousted because he refused, apparently, to go on television and to defend some of these policies, including the Taliban. But if it turns out to be that, this is one of those moments where John Bolton, and again, I'm not a pro John Bolton, you know, eternal war guy, but where he was right that, and the editors of National Review, your publication, were right that the Taliban should not have been allowed to get within 5,000 miles of Camp David.
Oh, of course.
Of
course not. I mean, you know, look, with the Bolton appointment to National Security Advisor, it was always, you know, on the one hand, it seemed like a mismatch because here was a president who had scorned the war in Iraq, who had vowed repeatedly to bring the troops home. So on the one hand, and Bolton is, you know, famously on much more on the hawkish side of the GOP divide. Yet at the same time, Trump has also been extremely aggressive in his rhetoric in other ways. So, you know, bring the troops home and kick the crap out of ISIS. And those are not necessarily compatible objectives. And so there was a side of Trump, this sort of side that's I'm the toughest guy in the room, that I could see a Bolton appointment actually feeding. But then there was also this side of Trump that I don't want to be in any new wars. I want to get out of the wars that we're in, that was incompatible in many ways with the Bolton appointment. So there, from the beginning, I think when you have the commander in chief who seems to not have a particular guiding principle, encountering a person who is known for having a certain set of guiding principles, it was going to be a fraught relationship.
Yeah, all along. It was, and my sense is that John Bolton is not going to be going quietly here. That this is going to be more like Mooch than like Mattis. I don't think that there's going to be any restraint that you could tell. And this was one of the more extraordinary events on Tuesday, and it was only Tuesday. It's going to be one of those weeks, you know that,
where exactly
where he's tweeting out refuting the president, saying, you know, I was not fired, I quit, and then apparently on speed dial began calling every single reporter that he knew and either texted them or called them to tell his side of the story, which I think is a pretty good indication that John Bolton is not going to go quietly into this good night.
Well, the Mattis-like restraint that essentially says, you know, I'm going to wait a decent interval before I say what I really think. I'm not sure that's going to apply to Bolton. It's going to be interesting to know if he has one of those non-disclosure agreements, those legendary non-disclosure agreements. But I concur. It seems as if we're going to hear more sooner than perhaps with, other recently fired Trump appointees. And look, part of me is, on the one hand, there is something unseemly about departing an administration and then sort of like just calling in an airstrike on all your bridges. You're burning them so thoroughly. But on the other hand, what the heck is going on with this Taliban negotiation? I mean, this is a war we can't forget, because I wrote against a total withdrawal and a deal with the Taliban. And I kept getting these weird comments like, well, that's just leave Afghanistan to the Afghans. I mean, what's the national security harm in that, leave them out there on the whole other side. They're all the way there on the other side of the world. It's a tribal society. What's the worst that can happen? Well, I'll tell you what the worst can happen. We saw it on 9/11. I mean, this is the nation that harbored the terrorists who attacked us in the most, the most dramatic attack on our soil since the British invaded the continental U.S. in the War of 1812. I mean, and so, that's the stakes. Those are the stakes here. And it does not seem as if we have anything approaching a coherent plan. There's inertia in place. There's sort of a war by inertia. But what the heck is going on?
Well, you're absolutely right, which is going to be very interesting how a lot of the conservative media, who I think were uniform in their condemnation of this idea of having this this dog and pony show at Camp David, will now react to all of this. But I also think that John Bolton is dangerous to the president because, like the president, I think he's a TV guy. He understands the power of TV.
That's
he knows
true.
That it's a TV show. And going back to why he handled it this way, I think the instinct of the of Trump was to try to discredit him before he went out and was more of a voluble critic. Okay, so moving on here, I actually have several things written down here. I have the word. I want to get to your piece on Elizabeth Warren, which I thought was very, very important, and come back to the debate with Soraya Bamari. But I have a word written down here since we've already invoked the word Frenchism. And for people who are late to this, I'm guessing a lot of the listeners of the podcast are familiar with this. Soraya Bamari goes out and he does sort of a half-assed tweet, which he then blows up into a half-assed article against Frenchism, in which he attributes all of the evils of modern society to David French, which has become kind of an interesting meme.
And by fascinating.
By which he means Frenchism, which appears to mean, pluralistic, tolerant, democratic, liberal constitutional society, that sort of thing. And saying this was a real threat to, the cultural order, to Christianity, to the faith, etc. And the word I have written down here on my notepad is Falwellism versus Frenchism. And my thought is, what is the greater threat to the Christian witness and to social conservatism? Is it liberal democracy, or is it the kind of incredible, hypocritical, grifting corruption that we're now learning even more about from the Jerry Falwell Jr.'s? And I'm talking about that Politico, extraordinary Politico piece. And maybe some of the indications of cracks in Liberty University, which has been really kind of a cult of personality. I'm kind of blown away by how awful the story is, and yet how much the new right has been willing to tolerate Falwellism, you know, in contrast, all of the energy directed at liberal democracy, for example.
Yeah, you know, it's part of this is driven by this overriding sense of emergency. So, you know, people are willing to overlook a multitude of sins if you're on the right side in the sense of emergency. And so, you know, Falwell has been, and I think that the clock is actually ticking on him, because I think that no one is as immune to the consequences of their own actions as Trump. Not even many of Trump's closest allies are as immune as he is. So I think the clock is kind of ticking on him, but there's a lot of grace and forgiveness in the larger right-wing community for those who they believe jumped, stormed the cockpit in the Flight 93 election. And it's that sense of emergency that has justified the embrace, say, of Falwellism, for example. And the interesting thing is, I think that people have now become emotionally invested in the idea that there's an emergency, an extraordinary emergency, because if you question that narrative, then you have to question the decisions you made based on that sense of emergency. And so I have sort of two kinds of pieces I write that get the biggest negative reaction. One is, of course, when I critique Trump. I mean, that's just the expected. The other one is whenever I say, you know what, conservatives actually did win some things before Trump, or the culture is not in the kind of downward spiral that you think that it is, that we actually have made great strides in some areas. Yeah, we have challenges, no question. I mean, no question we have challenges. But when you question the narrative of that this is a sort of a historic crisis point in our nation, people actually get angry at that.
David Beiler had a good piece about that cultural conservatives have actually been winning the culture war. I mean, obviously some high profile setbacks, but they've actually been doing a lot. And I noticed that you tweeted out a thread of somebody looking historically, for example, at church going in American culture, you know, and saying, yes, you know, that, you know, in early America, the elites were pretty churchy, but early America was drunker, gambled and patronized prostitutes more, had abortions more corruption, more dangerous, plus slavery, sweatshops, child labor, sex exploitation. It was hardly nirvana. So when people look around and go, what a hellscape we live in, I'd be like, wait,
yeah.
Compared to what?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was just talking to some Christian university educators earlier today, and we're talking about the profound lack of historical perspective and the profound idealization of the past. You know, it's as if we look back at 19th century America and we see Little House on the Prairie, you know, where you have Ma and Pa and you have this really super tight-knit community and everybody's at church. And, you know, it's a concern if somebody isn't at church. And you look at that and you go, man, we have really spiraled downward. And yet, you know, it's actually the case that we are right now near historic American highs in actual church attendance and belonging to religious institutions. Now, we've declined from the absolute peak, but we're still at, you know, close to historic highs. And so that's an interesting data point. Again, it doesn't in any way diminish the fact that we have challenges, and I hate to see some of our denominations declining. I think that's a real problem. But, I like what my colleague Ramesh Panuru said. Rather than sort of looking at the culture war as sort of this one thing, different issues have had different outcomes and have different trends. And so he has said that, you know, in the last quarter century or so, America has become more pro-life, more pro-gun, and more pro-gay.
True.
And I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true. Okay, so I want to talk about a piece that you had up, and I linked it in my newsletter on Tuesday about Elizabeth Warren's constitutional problems. You know, she's got a plan for everything. Unfortunately, much of it is, when it comes to regulations, it is probably illegal. When it comes to the legislation she wants to push, it is probably unconstitutional. And then I want to double back on your debate with Sohrab. So let's do this in a couple of moments. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
Okay, we're back with David French. You know, when we started this, we were talking about the very high-profile debate you had with Sohrab Ahmari at Catholic University. And I'm sorry I wasn't there in the room. I was actually watching it being live-streamed. I was actually sitting out in my yard with my dogs, you know, 1,000 miles away watching you, which was a bizarre experience. But I thought it was an incredibly revealing moment. But you were telling me that the one thing, of course, I missed was what the vibe in the room was like. I mean, I wasn't there.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the first things I noticed, I got there almost an hour beforehand, and there were a lot of people already there, which is not the norm for a political gathering,
for a political debate.
Yes. And I remember when we were first talking about doing this with Ross and Sohrab, there was I can't remember who said it, was it Ross or Sohrab, but said something along the lines of, you know, rather than it being a debate, it should be more like a podcast style conversation. And what actually turned into a podcast, all right, if it was the WWE hosting a podcast. But there you could tell that there was a tension in the room, or at least I perceived that, so a sort of a tension and an energy, which in many ways, you know, reflects, I think, sort of the larger tension, palpable tension you sort of see in the right online and in real life, as, you know, we're working through these questions about what does it mean to be a conservative? What should the GOP look like in the coming years? What should a conservative movement look like in the coming years? I mean, these are very live, very emotional questions, and you could sense that in the room.
So let's talk about specifically about the drag queens. And because this does all begin with laughing about this, but I mean, this was the heart of the entire debate. In fact, it's the heart of the entire controversy, where Sohrab tweets out about this drag queen story hour in one library and what we should do about it. And he says, look, we're irrevocably opposed to this. There's no polite David Frenchian third way around a cultural civil war. The only way is through. Okay, it wasn't clear what he actually meant. So your position is basically, you know, you don't like drag queen story hours, but you want to preserve First Amendment protected rights of viewpoint neutral access to public facilities for everyone, right? I mean, that's your
right.
position. And that there's
right.
really no alternative to this. So as you wrote, you should counter bad speakers in the marketplace of ideas, not through the heavy hand of government censorship. Okay, so that's not enough. That's the problem. What is Sohrab's better plan?
You know, I don't really know. I mean, at the debate, he had said, well, there should be a hearing with the head of the Modern Library Association, which I don't think is an organization that actually exists, and with Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, and then make that person sweat. Well, you know, I mean, that's not really an answer to anything. And in fact, if you bring in a very prepared, you know, poised librarian, they're going to also talk about all of the various other kinds of activities that occur at libraries that all, you know, that Americans broadly love. And often when you try to bring somebody in front of a hearing to own the libs, sometimes they just refuse to be owned. And so that's not an answer. So I kept pressing on that. And he then very clearly said that he would want local ordinances passed that would very clearly and specifically ban drag queen reading hour. And I said, even at the expense of this doctrine of viewpoint neutrality that has allowed people from all kinds of walks of life to have access to public facilities. And he affirmed that clearly and unequivocally. And
so this is a rejection of the entire concept of viewpoint neutrality, which has been hugely important for conservative organizations and Christian organizations.
Oh my
gosh. In his legal history.
I mean, you know, this has been the subject of literally 38 years of litigation. I mean, going all the way back to 1981 in a case called Widmar v. Vincent. And this was a university denied access to empty classrooms. I mean, you know, facilities that were not in use to Christian organization on the grounds that allowing Christians to worship together on public ground would violate the Establishment Clause. I mean, it was an amazing argument, but it's one that had a lot of currency at that time, and the Supreme Court rejected that. And then in case after case, from Good News Club to Rosenberger versus Regents of Virginia and on, this zone of access to public facilities, sometimes even to public funds, has kept growing and growing and growing, and to the point now where, you know, on any given week, tens of thousands of Christian student groups are meeting on public property. Any given Sunday, thousands of churches are meeting on public property. You have what, about 35 chapters of Drag Queen Reading Hour?
35
chapters. You have millions of people in tens of thousands of churches and chapters and clubs taking advantage of this viewpoint neutral access to public facilities. And, you know, all these critics keep coming at me and going, well, stop saying viewpoint neutrality is neutral. No, I don't say it. I say viewpoint neutrality is good. It's just. It provides an equal access to facilities that taxpayers help build with their hard-earned tax dollars.
I mean, well, and here's also the cognitive dissonance of his rejection of viewpoint neutrality, because for many on the right, the particularly the Trumpist right, the centerpiece of their ideology is the judiciary, is to have a conservative federalist society right. Judiciary. And it would certainly be my impression that the vast majority of judges that have been come through the Federalist Society that are going on the federal bench, appointed by President Trump and confirmed by the Republican Senate, are strong advocates for exactly the kind of position that you are articulating. Are there any of these judges that have come out basically said, yes, I think we need to move past the First Amendment? I mean, so on the one hand, you have this group of conservatives that are, you know, constitutional originalists, except for the First Amendment, it sounds like.
Well, and it's very bizarre that you would say that the problem, you know, fringism is a problem, but Trump's greatest achievement is nominating a bunch of people who's have the exact same constitutional philosophy that I do.
Okay, so this was my main takeaway from watching this, was like, I always wondered whether there was any there when it came to this new illiberalism. It just seemed like it was hollow at the core. They kind of knew what they were against. But the extent to which the vacuousness was exposed was actually breathtaking, because I figured that there would be something a little bit more plausible, but it was, I mean, it was... it was tough to listen to, because I kept reaching for, you've got to have a better argument than that. And then, of course, it ended with quite a emotional high point when I actually played this the soundbite from your debate on the podcast the other day. I think it was when I was talking with Stephen Hayes, where Amari, you know, talks about, you know, the need to be strong and how Trump had stood behind Brett Kavanaugh, and, you know, a President French never would have had the guts to do that. And you pushed back, talking about your service in Iraq, and then among the classic bad lines of all time. And he didn't say you were just a JAG. He didn't use the word just, but he said you were a JAG. And tell me from your point of view what that felt like when he goes, oh, come on, you were a JAG.
Well, so here is there's a lot of subtext to this that a lot of people who don't follow these things don't really understand, because the reality is, it's a huge part of the attack upon David Frenchism, an attack basically on people who are still not on the Trump train, who are also conservative, is an attack on their alleged lack of toughness, that this draft dodger is the paragon of toughness. The, you know, this Donald Trump is the paragon of masculinity and toughness, and those people who still are not on board with him are just simply not ready for the fight. You're not tough enough. Only Trump is tough enough. And that
you're not manly enough. You're not courageous enough.
Exactly.
You know, he fights, you don't.
Yes. And so there's something inherently weak and cowardly about you not jumping on the Trump train. And this is sort of been a subtext. It's been sometimes often explicitly text. And one of the things that this all depends on is this all, you know, there's this only Trump argument, only Trump. And what I tried to do was interject that, no, we actually have a recent historical parallel of a nominee under incredible fire over sexual misconduct allegations. And that was Clarence Thomas. And George H.W. Bush stood by Clarence Thomas. And people don't acknowledge that. He actually got him through a Democrat-controlled Senate. And there's no appreciation of that, no acknowledgement. And so rather than deal with that argument, he just went ad hominem. And when he said that I wouldn't have stood by Kavanaugh, even though I had stood by Kavanaugh, I had written very strongly in his defense, I knew what was happening there. What he was saying is I didn't have the courage to stand by Kavanaugh. And that's why I got angry. You know, there's sort of, you know, in hindsight, would it have been better for me to say, what are you talking about? I actually did stand behind Kavanaugh. You know, maybe. But, you know, when a person is taking on, who's basically without any foundation, just taking on your most basic courage as a man, well, you're going to get upset about that. You're going to respond to that.
And you point out how much of the debate that we have these days is just simply ad hominem. It doesn't actually make a point. It is just sort of, you know, yo mama or whatever. And I thought it was legitimate to push back on all of that, because you're right. And you say it's the subtext, and it is the subtext, but sometimes it's the only text. I mean, there's a whole branch of sort of conservative trolling out there that is actually about nothing other than basically waving, I'm not going to say it, but waving your you know what in the air, and that sort of thing. So it's not a side issue, and it's hard to express how central this is to a certain brand of Trumpian, you know. He fights. He's tough. You guys are cucks. You guys are, you know, wimps. You guys
betas.
Very much so. It's very much alpha, beta. And so reminding people that you went and served your country in Iraq and got into Humvees in hostile territory when you did not have to do that was relevant to, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, and you know, you're exactly right that a lot of this is just sort of waving your you know what in the air online. But another reason why, you know, in the moment it seemed right to go to that point is because we really are at this weird stage where we are discussing fighting in the context of tweeting, right? You know, we're discussing bravery and the courage in the context of being just a total jerk online. And that's not courage. You know, that's not bravery. That's not even really fighting all that much. It's just snarking. And you know, so we have this whole weird parallel universe version of masculinity on the right, on the online right, not in the, you know, normal world where well-adjusted people live, but in the online right that is ascribing masculine virtues to the vigor of your tweets or the nastiness of your rhetoric. And that's, I'm sorry, that's not where courage is defined. That's not where strength is defined. That's not where virtue is defined. And yet it is there is a relentless drumbeat, relentless. And I'm not ascribing all of that to Sohrab. I mean, you know, I don't know that he, you know, the full of extent of his thoughts about all of this, but I am ascribing that to a legion of commenters and commentators on the Trumpist right, who are just utterly convinced at their masculinity and their valor based literally on their tweeting and their snarking. It's astonishing.
Yeah, and I think the people who don't swim in that water, which I would not recommend people doing, would understand exactly how powerful this is and how and you know, and frankly how silly it is. And by the way, can I point out that Sohrab at various points has run away and quit Twitter, so I don't think that he would base all of his courage on his Twitter persona, or certainly should not. Okay, I will also
we should also say that he did apologize. He did apologize for raising. What was pretty clearly mocking my service in Iraq. He did apologize for that.
Yeah, and I think that was appropriate. Okay, in the time we have left, back to some more substance here. I was fascinated by your piece that you had about Elizabeth Warren's plans for everything consistently violate the law. Look, I think it's more and more plausible that Elizabeth Warren could, I don't think she will, but she certainly could be the Democratic nominee. And she has taken a position on just about everything. And one of the things that strikes me again and again watching many of the Democratic candidates is that even though they run against Donald Trump, you know, in criticizing his violation of constitutional norms, that on a routine basis, they pledge to violate constitutional norms. You know, Kamala Harris, if Congress doesn't act on guns, she is going to unilaterally, you know, issue decrees. Let's leave Bernie Sanders aside. But Elizabeth Warren, you walk through this, how consistently she pushes the margin. So I just want to walk through the piece. People should go read the piece on National Review. But, you know, for example, you know, at the incredibly shambolic town hall meetings on the climate, which was basically just an oppo orgy for the Trump campaign, I thought she's pledging that she would ban fracking, that right. She would just use her power ban fracking. You're pointing out that there's some legal problems with that.
Yeah, you know, not only are there some legal problems, there's actually relatively recent court precedent from an Obama appointed judge who notes that when the Obama administration tried to use the Bureau of Land Management to enact fracking regulations, which is a whole lot less intrusive than Warren's pledge of a unilateral ban on all fracking on public and private lands, it was talking about regulating fracking on public lands in a far less intrusive way. An Obama appointee judge struck it down and said, you know, there has been a congressional enactment, and there was actually a congressional statute passed, the Energy Policy Act in 2005, that provided fracking with a broad degree of legal protection. So she can't trump that. So, you know, say goodbye to the unilateral fracking ban.
You also point out that the Consumer Financial Protection bureaucracy, which was basically her, one of her crown jewels, you describe that as being on constitutional life support with the prognosis not being that good for it.
But
I wanted to go right to the big one, because almost everything she talks about is predicated on this huge wealth tax. I mean, this is what's going to pay for everything. It's a huge departure politically, because it's not taxing gains. It's not taxing income. She's talking about taxing wealth. We don't really do that in this country. Europeans tried it. They realized it was a disaster. But you're pointing out that, you know, not surprisingly, the Elizabeth Warren wealth tax has constitutional problems, to put it mildly.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and it's actually reasonably simple. The Constitution bans what it calls a direct tax unless it's in proportion to the census or enumeration. Now, we don't even really have to get into all the nitty-gritty about what it means to be in proportion to the census or enumeration, because her wealth tax is not by any stretch or measure. And so this provision was one of the reasons why we needed the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which allowed for a tax on income specifically. So there is no amendment to the Constitution that prevents the operation of this ban on a direct tax unless it's in proportion to the census or enumeration. She can have a tax on income from wealth, but the actual tax on wealth itself is going to run into this problem. And, you know, it's funny how, you know, you'll see this. It's as, you know, as predictable as the sun rising in the East and setting in the West. As soon as a leading progressive politician proposes a probably unconstitutional law, you'll get some scholarship from law professors that are, well, actually, here's a different way you can look at it, and here's a different way that these words can be read. Perhaps the Supreme Court would buy those different ways, but the meaning of the words on the page, the intent of the words on the page, and the composition of the court lead me to believe that this wealth tax doesn't have much chance of surviving its first contact with courts.
So on abortion, she is proposing creating a national statutory right to an abortion which would override all of the state laws. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, so this
one, I mean, from a constitutional point of view.
Right, right. I mean, yeah. So this one is actually a favorite of Democratic politicians for a long time. And the answer is essentially answered in the Obamacare case, that what she would be doing is, rather than regulating interstate commerce, she would be mandating the creation of a market. And it wouldn't just be interstate commerce, so it would be intrastate commerce. In other words, a local abortion clinic attended that a person goes to from a local community, as opposed to crossing state lines. And so this is beyond, so far beyond regulating. It's essentially mandating the creation of a market that's beyond the scope of the Commerce Clause. And on the Commerce Clause reasoning alone, it should fail. Now, there are some other more complicated problems with it as well, related to competing liberty interests. But so again, what you would have is the Congress of the United States stepping in to mandate the creation of a market that was otherwise prohibited by state law. And that would be an enormous encroachment on state authority, and not justified by the Commerce Clause.
So bottom line here is, if she becomes president, that her supporters should prepare for some disappointment, which seems to follow on this pattern, this bipartisan pattern that we now have of both parties grossly overpromising, ginning their base up, only to let them down. And then, of course, the only recourse they have is to say that the other side betrayed them or sabotaged them, and the partisan cycle continues.
You are so right. I mean, and this is really destructive to our body politic, because essentially what happens is these really grandiose problems become almost like a form of policy as virtue signaling. So, you know, I am the kind of person who would do X, Y, and Z, even though I know full well as I talk about it that I cannot do X, Y, and Z. But, you know, not everyone understands the political reality. And in fact, I would say that most people don't understand the political reality. They don't get that these politicians are promising far beyond anything they can remotely deliver. And look, I know politicians overpromising has long been a problem. But in this case, you know, when government is so closely divided, when the possibility of obtaining a secure and enduring majority is so slim, I thought it was so telling in the first debate, when I believe it was Chuck Todd asked Elizabeth Warren, and he said, you know, you have a plan for everything. Do you have a plan for dealing with Mitch McConnell? And the answer was, She tried to say she did, but the answer was she does not have a plan. And so, you know, if you look back at the last even just 20 or so years, it seems as if presidents have been able to get like maybe one big piece of legislation through, maybe two. And then it's a whole bunch of small ball regulations that get reversed by the next president and, you know, the battle of the judicial appointments, of course. But a lot of it is Trump got a temporary tax cut. Obama got Obamacare, of course. Bush got a temporary tax cut and some legislation that not very many people remember anymore, like No Child Left Behind. But nobody would say that, you know, Bush enacted waves of legislation. Well, you know, I guess his biggest one was Medicare Part D. So each, you know, each president has sort of gotten a health care plan or a health care. Bush and Obama had health care. Bush had temporary tax cuts. Trump had temporary tax cuts. These are not nation changing events. These are this is sort of in the scope of American history, pretty small ball. And yet we are absolutely polarized.
Yeah. And there is no policy of modesty. I mean, there's no politics of modesty.
No,
there's nobody who says, okay, my goal is not to mess things up, which, by the way, now defines my definition of conservatism, which is don't mess things up. Just do no harm, because I don't think you can do any better than do no harm. So.
Well, you know, it's sort of a politics that says of humility, that says, you know, we have an immensely complicated nation and culture made up of a widely diverse group of Americans with widely diverse groups of beliefs. And the idea that I can sail into Washington and our technocrats are better than your technocrats and our technocrats will make everything right and your technocrats are a bunch of blithering idiots is, I think, is a terrible argument. And you know, at a time when America is more diverse than it has ever been, and through the Big Sort, we are moving into communities that are more different from each other than they've been in a very long time, we're perversely increasing the power and the reach of the central government. And that is a recipe for catastrophizing these presidential elections. So everything seems to be so darn important because the federal government just keeps getting more power. It's a recipe for bad policy because different parts of the country are different, and policies that work one place don't necessarily work another. I mean, Obamacare is a great example of that. I mean, you can put in an Obamacare-style program in Massachusetts, which was which is a state of relatively high income and pretty low unemployment rate. I mean, uninsured rate to begin with, that was enjoying a one-time windfall, use it or lose it from the federal government. That's one thing. And then to say, well, you know, it worked out fine in Massachusetts, so therefore it will work just fine in Arkansas, in Texas, in California. No. No. So we need to restore, and people hate the word federalism because of the bad name it gained during the civil rights era. So let's just say localism. Can we just say localism? That I would like to see a president actually campaign and say, you know what, San Francisco, if you want to be progressive, you can be progressive. In Tennessee, if you want to be conservative, you can be conservative. And I'm not going to be the guy who says that I have figured out the program for Tennessee and California. I'm going to let Tennessee and California figure out their own program.
What's interesting about that, of course, is that that is the formula, perhaps, to break the fever of the all or nothing Flight 93 elections, which is that we're not going to impose the transportation policy that would work in Boston on Wyoming. We're not going to pretend right. That the environmental policies that will work in San Francisco are going to work in Louisville. So it's sort of a live and let live. And of course, you go back to that was exactly the system that the founders devised, right? Funny how that works. It's like, how do we not tear each other apart? How do we temper the overreach of the ideologues and the partisans? Well, it's not a mystery, and we don't really need to reinvent it. We need to reinvigorate it somehow, but it doesn't feel like it's going to be easy. So
yeah. Yes. All right, so. And, you know, we forget that the founders, you know, we look back and in our modern eyes, we go, oh, look at a bunch of white Christian males. That's not diverse. But if you look at the colonies, the religious, just the competing religious cultures running up and down the Eastern Seaboard represented many of the combatants of the wars of religion that had ended in the previous century. And the idea that those kinds of religious communities could live together in one nation was not exactly, could not be taken for granted. And so, you know, we look at that and we say no diversity. They were looking at that and saying staggering diversity. What do we do about this? And that's when you protect voluntary association. That's when you protect rights of free speech. That's when you protect local control. That's when you protect the ability of communities to organize themselves. And it'd be worth remembering that.
It is worth remembering that. And early in the Trump years, there was this sort of strange new respect for federalism among progressives who suddenly decided, hey, maybe it's not a great idea to invest all this power. However, it does seem that that this overlay of racial politics and the increasing fashion on the left of describing the founding fathers as slaveholders and the Constitution as being, you know, irremediably stained by slavery is making that a harder sell. And as you point out, you can't use terms like states' rights anymore because of that. So somehow that's going to be the task to basically find a way, and maybe it is localism, or you know, power to the, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
The word subsidiarity is not going to catch on. It's not going to be it's not going to be a hashtag thing. So.
No. And you know, the other thing to remember is everyone's a hypocrite about federalism.
Oh,
basically,
my God. Yes.
You know, it's so I remember, you know, that when during the Obama administration, this state of Arizona passed some statutes that were designed to aid in federal immigration enforcement to allow the state to have a greater authority to enforce federal immigration laws. And the Obama administration said, nope, don't want the help. Don't want Arizona to go its own way on its immigration statutes. Supreme Court strikes it down, and all Republicans are yelling federalism, federalism, federalism. So then you have California, and California essentially decides to become a sanctuary state with a bunch of sanctuary cities. And what do? The Trump DOJ sues against that. And so it's not federalism anymore. It's nationalism, nationalism, nationalism. And so, you know, federalism should be a principle of American government, not a tactic simply utilized by the party out of power.
David French, thank you so much for joining me again. I appreciate it very much. I always enjoy these chats.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast today. Our episode was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.